This episode of Vintage Stormfront Freaks has been previously recorded.
So this is Jim Williams. He created Hurricane City in 1997. I think that was when Brady was born. But one reason for the name Hurricane City are the predictions made at the beginning of each hurricane season for the top cities and islands that Jim thinks are at the highest risk based on simple mathematical formulas. All right. So since Jim started making city predictions in 2003, he's nailed at least 4 to 6 cities out of 20 each year that ended up getting hit. Now, Jim also runs a paving business in South Florida since 1987, tracks hurricanes with statistical input as a hobby since the late 70s, and holds no meteorology degree. That's pretty good statistics there, Jim. So what do you think of this season so far, and how'd you do this year?
This has been my best year of predictions. Since I've been doing this since 2003, and the only other year I can think that was even close to this year as far as accuracy was 2005. But people will say, well, that's because you had a whole bunch of storms. It's kind of like shooting a gun, you know, in all different directions, and you're going to get hit. You're going to hit something, right? But this year was a little different in the sense that it was only a little bit above average. We have, 11.7 for an average amount of named storms. This year, I got all of my top five, which hardly ever happens. Got 20% of the remaining 15, but overall, a very successful year. My number one for the U.S. was Wilmington. The eye went right, eye of Florence went right over Wilmington. And my number one was Sable Island, Nova Scotia, which had Hurricane Chris winding down to a tropical storm when it passed over the island. So very successful year. I'm very happy.
So what's your criteria? I mean, how do you decide if it's a hit, a miss, or how close?
Okay, well, the criteria is tropical storm force winds affecting the area. When the National Hurricane Center does their post analysis, well, even actually before they do their post analysis, they have a map that they show orange is tropical storm force winds, red are hurricane force winds. What I do is I use the HurTrack program, which allows me to use the range rings of the wind fields of each storm. The yellow being the tropical storm force winds, and the blue as well. And then when you get into the red, that's hurricane force winds. So after the season, I go back and tweak it. And I also use the reanalysis project from the HurDat, HurDat 2, and tweak everything from the past to make sure that it lines up with what is considered a brush versus a hit. And that's the biggest debate. What is a brush versus a hit?
Jim, do me a favor. Explain the HurDat and the UDAT and the MDAT and the what's that DAT?
Yeah. Okay. That's a reanalysis project from the Hurricane Research Division, and they're constantly going back in history and taking segments, maybe a 10-year swaths, and going back and reanalyzing all the hurricanes during that time period, and looking at ground observations and maybe past recon data and trying to refine what the winds actually were at landfall. And very rarely is there a track shift. It's usually an intensity shift, because we pretty much know what hurricanes made landfall, even going back to my database starts back at 1871. So I feel that since 1871, it's improved greatly since 1871. But even back in the late 1800s, we had an idea of at least where they made landfall. Now, a lot of the fish storms we didn't know about, but we knew where they made landfall, and we could probably go back and look at the old data and find out what the winds were in certain cities and, the data that they've been able to accumulate at the Hurricane Research Division.
1800s, you don't look that old, Jim.
I know. I'm older than younger than I look. Yeah.
You know what? That's a great point, Matt. Jim, talk to us some about your backstory. It says here you've been in South Florida for a while now, and you've been doing, you've been interested at least in hurricanes since the 1970s. Talk to us about, what got you all started? Was it a hurricane that came through? What was it?
For me, it was, I don't know if you guys, any of you know the late Bob Weaver, the weatherman from South Florida. he did a show at 5:55 right before the 6 o'clock news, and he would focus on the tropics and he would show the color radar when that was brand new. And I was just fixated on that show. And so I would watch him talk about tropical waves and these waves coming off Africa and developing into hurricanes. And so I started looking into it further and started doing a lot of my own research. And so I started making these maps. When I was in middle school, I had a map that filled up my whole wall, hurricane tracking map, the size of a whole wall.
Oh my God.
And wow. I drew it myself, put the grids on the map and tracked every storm. I used to do audio recordings. I would have a tape recorder and I would record everything. I still have some of those tapes. They're hysterical. Wow. You know, I'm a kid in middle school and I'm like, yeah. Oh, I'm pissed off because that storm didn't develop or it turned out to sea. You know, that's how obsessed I was. And I'm keep looking over here because I have a map. I don't know if I can show you this. I'm going to try to show you this map right there.
Explain it, since this is a podcast and a lot of people won't see it. Explain what you're showing.
Well, I'm showing a map on the wall. It's actually a door skin. It's the size of a door. And those tracks in red are all Category 5 hurricanes that have made landfall that have been verified. And I used to have this map all filled with all the storms, but it got to be so clustered that you couldn't tell one storm from the next. So I just decided, let me just focus on Category 5s just to keep it so I don't have to keep updating it because it's behind glass. So I have to take the glass off after the hurricane season. And if there's been a Category 5 landfall, I have to.
How far back are you going with that map?
That map is I have that since 1900. That's all Category 5 since 1900.
Okay.
Wow.
So I want to jump back, Jim, to, so you were talking about how you're determining the success of your assumptions and your predictions, and you talk about brushes. And a brush, you're kind of checking off as, okay, I got that one right. So you were going to talk a little bit about that. Explain, what's a brush, how close, or what's the definition?
Okay, take a storm like Katrina, for example. The hurricane force wind fields expanded out over 100 miles on that one. So I had to expand it a little further than normally. I mean, normally you're talking 60 to 80 miles for tropical storm force winds to impact an area. And then the core of the hurricane is usually 50, 60 miles of hurricane force winds. But in some of these storms, they're all different sizes. In fact, at Hurricane City, I have a in the drop-down menu, there's a link that says how big was it, and it takes all the past storms and it shows you how big they were compared to the next to the state of Florida. So you have big ones like Hurricane Mitch and Hurricane Gilbert and Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Allen, and then you have the tiny ones like Hurricane Andrew and Hurricane Charlie. And so I factor all those, the winds, the size of those winds, using the HurTrack program, like I said, and it gives you the range rings. You can go back and run all the past storms, and it gives you the range rings. So if it's within the aqua and the yellow area, which are tropical storm force winds, these are all based on HRD, Hurricane Research Division findings, and I just am able to animate it with that program. And I can go city by city by city and figure out whether it was a brush or hit based on those range rings.
So what's the lowest wind speed that would still fall within that range and be considered a brush?
Well, 40 miles an hour. I mean, that's the minimum tropical storm force winds. And tropical depressions don't count. That's not in the calculations at all. It's just tropical storms and hurricanes. And we include subtropical and extratropical systems as well. And then, of course, extratropical, they expand. So that also factors in for the Canadian Maritimes, for example. You have an extratropical system expanding out 200 miles. If that's the case, then we're going to include that as a brush.
Okay. Hmm. So what were your thoughts on this past year? Don't take into account your predictions, obviously, because you covered that a little bit. I'm just curious, what were your thoughts on this past year with the season, and what'd you think of it all?
It started out as I expected. It was a little bit slower. In fact, the first half of the season, a lot of people were like, well, this is turning out like we thought. This was going to be a slower than normal season. And then as the season progressed, in fact, this has happened the last few years, September, October comes around. It's like the lid comes off the tropics. And we're getting more late season storms, it seems, lately, October especially. I was, you know, I have my broadcast partner, Bill Phillips. We do live coverage of hurricanes when they make landfall. And we did cover Hurricane Florence, but I had a couple of funerals I had to attend. I had a lot of close friends that passed away this year. It's been tragic. And so I couldn't make it up there to cover Hurricane Florence. And my friend, my broadcast partner, Bill, said, well, I think that's it for the season. I think we're done. And I said, I don't agree with you. I think we're going to see a big one in October. Something's going to come, just like with Matthew. And even last hurricane season, when we had, you know, late September systems and going into October, I think we're going to get something big this year. And sure enough, Michael developed, and I got right back from a funeral I attended, turned right around and went right back up to Panama City, and I was in Hurricane Michael. I got in the eye of it.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. I was in that hurricane. Now this is an interesting story, because a lot of storm chasers, they like to, you know, hunker down. They'll be under an overpass or an overhang of a hotel, for example, or they'll, you know, get away from the high wind areas. They'll get inland or get outside of it. I decided, you know, and I know a lot of people are going to disagree with this, but I have a fortified vehicle. I put Lexan glass on the back of it to protect me. And I said, you know what? I'm going to go into this hurricane. I'm going to stream it live. I backed the truck into the wind in an open field where there is no trees, no power lines, no signs, no, you know, nothing that could injure me. And the truck did a perfect job. I was able to stream it live through the entire hurricane before, during, and after, got in the eye of it. We had about 80,000 viewers watching that on both Facebook and Periscope. But the Lexan glass did break on the backside eye wall. A piece of roofing material came up and shattered it. And if I had not had that glass on there, it might have came right through and hit me in the back of the head.
So, Jim, what was that like? I mean, it's one thing for us to see it, obviously, on Periscope. But it's another thing to actually be there. Like, were you ever scared? Or was there a moment where you're like, crap, what did I do?
There was the front side wasn't that bad. I was just north of Tyndall Air Force Base on the backside eye wall. And it was a little hairy. I mean, there were some things. Occasionally, you get one of those mesovortices that was passing by the truck, and the winds would shift, and something would come from the side or come from an odd direction other than the regular mean wind direction. And then the eye came, and I got the eye. And I was so busy running around with my camera filming and everything, I forgot to check the pressure. But I did use Barometer Plus on the phone, which is really interesting. A lot of people say, well, that doesn't work. But there's a sensor in the iPhone in the new versions that allow you to measure barometric pressure. And it measured 924.8 millibars, and that was before the eye. So I'm assuming I was in about 923 millibars. Yeah. But and I came home and tested that extensively, and it does work. It matches my weather instruments back here. So it's a really good app. But anyway, backside came, and that was when all hell broke loose. It was really bad. The backside, there was all the plywood that was protecting all the storefront windows just blew off. It was flying over the truck. There were aluminum flying by like missiles. You would not believe how fast things were flying by that truck. I say several times in the video, there's a short version. I have a 15-minute long video, which is all the oohs and ahs, so to speak. And then there's a longer version, which is a full documentary before, during, and after the hurricane. And the 15-minute version is just, you'll sit up in your chair and you won't believe it. Now, the one mistake I had was the truck was so well protected that you couldn't hear the wind that good. And a lot of people were like, well, there's a lot of things flying around, but we're not hearing a lot of wind. It was loud, but you couldn't hear it on the live feed. But it was really loud. Next year, I'm going to have an external microphone so that they can pick up the sound outside.
Yeah, what do they want you to do? Step outside? Are you kidding me?
No, I never crack my window. I don't step outside. That's just foolish. You'll get killed. I mean, there were things flying by at 150 miles an hour decapitate you. I mean, aluminum sheets that were 8 feet long, just whew, like missiles right by the truck. Crazy.
All right, hey, everybody, welcome back. Hey, so we're here with Jim Williams of HurricaneCity.com. Jim, you were talking a little bit about chasing and Michael down in Panama City. What I want to know is this. So if you talked about you've got the 15-minute version and you've got the over-hour-long version, What else are you doing while you're streaming the video? Are you talking? Are you looking at anything, updating people on what you're looking at? How's that work out?
Yeah, so we, when I say we, my partner, broadcast partner, Bill Phillips, he was taking my video and pushing it to the social networks because I didn't want to use my bandwidth from the road to try to pull this off. By the way, AT&T Networks was brilliant. They stayed up through the whole storm, allowed us to stream. We lost 15 minutes of airtime.
I heard that, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, during the whole live video presentation, we're showing – first of all, I have a remote camera as well. I know Mark Sudith from Hurricane Track does this too. We had a remote camera set up on the DuPont Bridge. Yeah, DuPont Bridge near Tyndall Air Force Base. And so when I went down, when my internet signal went down, Bill was able to show the remote camera. What all hell was breaking loose on that. Billboards coming down, aluminum flying by. It was like raining debris. And I would also show radar fixes of my current position using a radar scope. And we were showing, of course, the barometer app. And during the time that I was down, what Bill does is if he ever loses me in a storm, he shows either live web cameras that are on the internet or local news from the affected area. So people that are watching it, a lot of people evacuate these areas. So they want to watch it as it's happening. And I feel that's part of the service that we're providing. But not only that, it's giving people an education, like I said, about the aluminum flying by. This is kind of what you can expect when you're in a hurricane. We've covered all these hurricanes in the past at Hurricane City, making landfall. So I figured what better way to do it than actually being there and showing people what's happening. And we were talking to people before the hurricane came, you know, what are you going to do? Do you have a mattress to put over your head? That sort of stuff. And then afterwards, there were people coming up to me with all kinds of stories. The only thing I regret is I didn't interview more people in the aftermath. There were a lot of homeless people that had stories to tell. They were climbing up in trees and, you know, hiding in buildings from the storm surge. It was crazy.
That's hard to do. That's hard to do, though, right, is to approach people that are in that situation and
exactly.
Ask them their story. You're like, oh, I don't, yeah, should I
Yeah,
ask?
It was like
should
a zombie apocalypse. Like, everybody's walking around. Right. Like, it just didn't seem right. Like, everything was out of place. Nobody was in their right mind. I felt out of place. And, I, you know, that truck is what I have is a utility truck. So it looks like it's official. So I'm in the area, and I have – you know, all the, you know, like a typical like power truck is what it looks like. And so it's a big truck and people think, well, I was in there to start helping people right away. And that really wasn't my purpose there, but I was, you know, I would have helped any way I could, but there was power lines down, power poles down, blocking all the roads. I had to go around power poles to get to my remote camera. It was hair-raising. The most hair-raising part of this was that not actually the hurricane, but driving immediately after the hurricane, trying to navigate all the down power poles and lines. That place had so many power lines and power poles. I've never seen anything like it. And I'm from South Florida, where it's very congested down here. We have a lot of power lines and power poles, but I've never seen that many power lines and power poles crisscrossing roads.
It's more obvious when they're on the road.
Yeah, they were down everywhere. Okay. People, yep.
Do you run into a lot of people who are like, yeah, I remember back in 1964, we made it through hurricane, whatever. And they're like, you know, it wasn't that bad. So we're just going to ride this one out too. And you give them the service of like, okay, this is where like Armageddon is. And they get the opportunity to see that, because I think for most people, they never get to experience. And when they see it, they're just like, oh my gosh, I had no idea.
Yeah, well, I had a sense of that when I was there before the hurricane. I got in there the day before, and the hotel I stayed at, which was a Comfort Inn in Callaway, Florida. That's actually the city that I was in. And I went into the hotel and, you know, checked in, and I asked all the questions a storm chaser would ask, like, how thick are your windows? Do you have a generator? Do you have a second floor room? I don't want to get flooded out here in case things get really bad. And she's like, oh, it's not going to be that bad. You know, she wasn't comparing it to a past hurricane, but she didn't seem to be concerned at all about what was about to come. And I go, you have no idea what's coming here. I mean, this is like a tornado, basically, that's going to be over this area in a few hours. You know, it's going to be that bad. Your windows are going to blow in. And then I said, well, look, give me a south-facing room, because I figured, give me a north-facing room. Wait a minute. That would be east in Panama. So, yeah, give me an east-facing room because the winds are going to be primarily out of the west and southwest. That was my thinking, right? But that wasn't the way it turned out. The winds came around out of the east and northeast and were hammering the room that I was staying in, and all those windows busted out. But they abandoned the hotel. The people that were running the hotel, they were nowhere to be found the next day. There was roof leaks everywhere, people wandering the hallways. It was just unbelievable.
So I want to ask you, Jim, a little bit. I want to go back to, because here's what I love, and I think this is what our show is all about. We've got meteorologists and we have non-meteorologists, and our show is all about fun and entertaining and educating at the same time. But we love to embrace the weather geeks and the weather fans. And you may or may not be a meteorologist, but you just love weather. And you are not a meteorologist. So my question is, because I think, you know, that's embraced by us in our community. What is your background? And you talked a little bit about when you were growing up and the hurricanes you saw, but I want to know your background and how you got into now predicting, where you came up with this formula to be predicting hurricanes. Where'd that come from?
I'm glad you asked that question because I wasn't
You're
quite
welcome.
Finished explaining my prediction scheme. So what I did, this is kind of a long story. I'm going to try to keep it short. Back in the probably late 80s, early 90s, I had an old Epson computer. I don't know if you remember those old mono computers with the 5-inch floppy disk. So I created a program where when you put it, you put in category one, hit enter, and then it prints out all of the category ones that made landfall on a dot matrix printer. So I wrote that program and it prints out all these category one, and it went state by state by state. So I'm figuring, okay, if there's a cat one heading to Florida, I would put in Florida category one, and it would print out everything and what it did when they hit Florida, all the category ones. So as the years went by, my wife was and I were talking about, I need to get this stuff online. I need to go on the internet. 1995 went by, 1996, 97. I said, okay, let me go ahead and get an account going to make a website. I started at GeoCities and I called it Jim's Hurricane Web back in 1997. So I figured, okay, let me figure city by city, because if you go state by state, there's too many. It's too large of data for it going state by state. And I wanted to go city by city because I figured if you narrow it down, it really gives the people an idea of where hurricanes hit more one place than another place. Because everybody knows the most hurricanes hit Florida. So that's you know, pretty much, and North Carolina, the Outer Banks. But if you go city by city, it's kind of different. So I decided, let me separate them all by about 50 miles and go all through the Caribbean and the United States and collect all the data on brushes and hits going all the way back to 1871. So it was a painstaking process. I would spend hours in libraries going over microfilm data, old hurricane books. I'd go to the Hurricane Center Library at the Hurricane Center. I spent hours there, and I ran into former directors such as Bob Sheets, and you know, I would do my research there and put all this together and decided, okay, once I get this put together, people can use this as a tool to figure out their city. Because if you say, again, if you say a state, it doesn't mean much to people. But if you say Miami and you live in Miami, then that has a whole new meaning. You can say, go to Miami. It'll tell you the most likely time of the year that Miami's going to be hit by a hurricane. It'll tell you the return rates for tropical storms and hurricanes. It'll tell you the return rates for major hurricanes. It'll tell you all the history of all the past hurricanes that hit directly. And not only that, it gives you all the NHC final reports. It'll give you maps, radars, everything for every hurricane that's ever hit that particular city. Then after calculating all that and getting it all put together, I figured, okay, let me come up with a ranking scheme. What cities get hit the most versus others? And I took all the 140 total cities. That includes all the United States coastal cities and the Atlantic Basin and the Caribbean islands, and I rank them, who gets the most hurricanes, who gets the most tropical storms. And that's a whole other page. It's called hurricanecity.com/rank. So you can see the rankings of all the cities. Then I decided, why not create a predictive scheme based on this? Because if I can calculate all this data, I can kind of figure out based on how active a hurricane season is going to be as to who might be most vulnerable. During busy hurricane seasons, there's certain areas that are very vulnerable, and slow hurricane seasons, there's certain areas that are very vulnerable. And then you combine that with the return rates and you have a formula.
So here's my question. Is that formula, is that proprietary or is that something you've shared?
Oh, I've shared it. I put it on. I have a blog that I've written, and I write it before each hurricane season. Okay. It explains specifically what the process is. And the newest things that I've added to the 8 criteria that I use is the North Atlantic Oscillation and ENSO analog years. And since I've added the North Atlantic Oscillation, the predictions have been outstanding. And what I do is in mid-April, when I start calculating everything, because I release it on May 15th, in mid-April, I look at the NAO and I go, okay, in May, is the NAO positive or negative? And then I decide, okay, well, I don't decide, but I look at the data. And if it says it is a positive NAO at that time of the year, then I'll go back in history to the cities that I've chosen to be in my top 20 based on return rates and everything. And then I use the NAO to narrow it down. And I say, okay.
Which is what? What's the NAO?
The North Atlantic Oscillation, when it's positive.
What does that mean?
Well, when it's positive, there's cooler waters in the tropical Atlantic heading toward, and quicker trade winds heading towards the Caribbean and the mean development region in the Atlantic. When it's negative, it's more warmer and slower. Now, that's not for me to tell you the science behind the NAO. What I just do is take whether it's positive or negative and then apply that to the cities that I've chosen based on return rates. And then if there's a period, say they've been hit 8 times when there's a positive NAO, I would say, okay, that's a yellow shaded area there on my criteria. If they've been hit 8, like that happened last year with Irma. Marathon was picked because 8 times in history when there's a positive NAO, Marathon was hit by a hurricane. So I thought that was really outstanding. And that's why they made the top 5 and they were hit by Irma last year.
Welcome to Outbreak, a new live stream format brought to you by the Stormfront Freaks podcast, hosted by me, meteorologist Brady Harris, also known as Stormcat 5. We'll go live on days of extreme weather with the goal of keeping you safe, informed, and entertained. The only question that remains is, are you ready for the outbreak?
Awesome. Thank you. We have Dr. Phil Klotzbach, who's here today, the real Dr. Phil, just saying. He's a research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Science at Colorado State University. He was co-author on the Atlantic Basin Hurricane Forecast through 2005 and became the first author on the Seasonal Hurricane Forecast in 2006. Welcome, Dr. Phil. How are you tonight? Woo! Good.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Awesome. So first question I have for you, before we really get into everything, how did you decide, I want to be a researcher?
Well, I've always been obsessed with the weather since I was a kid. And so I've always just kind of been fascinated with like what makes the weather tick. I remember when I was like 5 or 6 years old, getting up at like 5:30 in the morning to watch AM weather on PBS. I'm not sure if any of you remember that. But yeah, and always would basically, I grew up in Massachusetts, so it was always... I grew up in Massachusetts, but in Plymouth, so right on the water. And so most of the time, the nor'easters would track a little too close to the coast and it would change to rain, which is very sad. So I had my dad like print out blank maps of the U.S. and I would try to draw synoptic weather patterns that would give us the most snow. So yeah, I've always been obsessed with the weather. And we had Hurricane Gloria go through when I was 5. And that really got me interested in hurricanes specifically and what makes them tick. And you know, I had the great privilege of working with Dr. Bill Gray for about 15 years, and he just had this insatiable curiosity, wanting to know, you know, spent his entire life studying hurricanes and wanted to know why hurricanes behave the way they do, and still trying to figure it out. There's certainly, it's a challenging thing, because like the weather, we get clues, we have rough ideas, but then things sometimes don't pan out the way that we expect. And so I think that's really kind of what research is, right? So I do research, but I also do forecasting. We do seasonal hurricane predictions every year at Colorado State. We also do sub-seasonal forecasts, so how busy the next, say, 2 weeks are going to be. Sometimes the forecasts turn out well, sometimes they don't. And when they don't, when you bust, that's actually when you, I think, learn the most. So I've just tried to, you know, we can get into talking about what happened this past year. And there's some things that worked out well, some things that didn't. So trying to kind of figure out why didn't things quite play out the way that we expected, and then trying to obviously take that into account so it's that in the future, when seasons like 2022 present themselves, we can have forecasts that are even better than what we had this past year.
Do you have a favorite weather? Favorite type?
A favorite weather condition?
Yeah, or type, or storm, or I mean, is there one thing you're like, oh, that's my favorite?
Yeah, I mean, being in Colorado, it really, it's really hard to beat Mammatus clouds. Those are some of my favorites. And so, well, I worked for Colorado State since 2000. I actually worked remotely and lived in the Northern California for about 7 years, and I was very, very convectively deprived. And so we moved back. We moved back to Colorado and lived in the mountains for a few months. And when I was living in the mountains, especially in the San Juan Mountains in Southwest Colorado during peak monsoon season, it was like every day just mammatus clouds. It was. I felt like I got to kind of catch up on all the convection I missed over a few years. So yeah, I would say those are probably my favorite ones. It's also Colorado, we do occasionally get these kind of these Kelvin-Helmholtz waves, which are kind of basically instability clouds, and those are really cool, especially when you can actually see the crest of the waves actively breaking. But that often is involved with really windy weather, so not necessarily want to be out in it for too long.
That's awesome. So I've been watching, you know, paying attention to Bill Gray's forecasts, you know, his seasonal hurricane forecast. He's like the guy, right, for years and years and years. And you had the privilege of working with him. You got to give me a peek behind the scenes here briefly. You know, what was it like working with him? You said he, you know, had this great curiosity, but, you know, tell us more about what it was like to work for such an icon.
Yeah, I mean, he was an amazing guy to work for. I worked with him for about 15 years towards the end of his career. So when I started working with him, he would have been 69 years old. Just a fascinating guy. He had an interesting kind of background. So he got his start in weather in the Air Force, forecasting for the Air Force. And then he actually had his undergraduate degree in geography, and then got, which is also my undergraduate degree, so go geography, and then got his master's and PhD in atmospheric science from the University of Chicago, and then came out to Colorado State. It's amazing what he did with the data that he had. Now, when we're so spoiled, we can go and get any, you can go online and be like, hey, what was the weather on whatever day? And just, you know, you can do all sorts of plots really, really easily. The data is all there. And back then, like he had to basically know what he was looking for ahead of time, because he would call people up and say, hey, send me data from this one particular weather station. I think that's really what I think his legacy is he was very much an empiricist. He basically let the data kind of dictate where he was going to go. So he's kind of best known in the general public for his seasonal hurricane forecast. But I mean, he made fundamental contributions to tropical cyclone Genesis, his parameters for why storms form where they do. Why we don't, say, for example, get very many storms, say, in the South Atlantic Ocean, why we get them when we do, where we do. Those parameters haven't been tweaked very much since his initial paper published in 1968. He made fundamental contributions to even tropical just convection, so when we get thunderstorms, why tropical convection tends to peak during the early morning hours. And so in all these different areas, so in addition to just the seasonal forecast, just really a giant in the field, and really also just a very interesting guy to work for. He just had a really good sense of humor, and just a real character. And I think the thing with Bill Gray is every single person who met Bill Gray, even if they only met him once, has a story about him. Like he would make some sort of comment that would leave you scratching your head and laughing. So just a real character, in addition to being a brilliant scientist. And he was kind of like my grandfather too. Gave a nice toast at my wedding and stuff like that. So just really, really blessed I've had the chance to work with him for as long as I did, and try to kind of keep his legacy alive as long as we can. There's also Dr. Gray had, I believe, about, 40 master's students, 20 PhD students, something like that, maybe even more. So basically anyone who's in the Bill Gray Research Project, we always try to meet up and get together whenever we get the opportunity. So it's really neat to have had the chance to work with him.
That's awesome. So talking about this hurricane season then, you know, you alluded a little bit to some of the, it was a little crazy. So I know the forecast came out saying, hey, this hurricane season is going to probably be above average. I feel like everything was tracking along really well. And then August hit. So you want to talk a little bit about, you know, what went on in August and why it dropped such a big dry spell during a time where we were supposed to have, you know, be reaching our peak for hurricanes.
Sure. Yeah. And so, you know, I gave a talk for the EMS weather band at the end of November. And I basically said 2022, the most, abnormal, normal season on record. So at the end of the day, the numbers look like pretty much a dead on average season, you know, nothing to see, not that exciting. But it was extremely unusual in the way that it behaved. So we had a fairly busy in June into early July, and then nothing from, I believe, July the 3rd through the end of August. It's the first time that had happened since 1941, when Ted Williams
threw
406 for my hometown Boston Red Sox. So it had been a long, long time to go that long with no storms. And our group at Colorado State, NOAA, all these other groups do seasonal forecasts were saying busy, busy season. We had no storms in August and a really busy September, and then a really quiet October followed by a really busy November. So at the end of the day, it ended up average. But August was, I think that was the biggest surprise, in that end of September, at least the stuff I was looking at, we could say, okay, October was likely to be fairly quiet. But August, even early August, we didn't expect it. And even the dynamical models, so the numerical models, like the European Center model, the global forecast system from the U.S., were all pretty robust at forecasting a busy second half of August. You had La Nina, which is colder than normal water in the eastern and central tropical Pacific. Normally when that occurs, that reduces levels of vertical wind shear. So while vertical wind shear in general is what you want if you want severe weather, vertical wind shear is bad for the hurricanes. It basically suppresses hurricane development by tilting the hurricane vortex. So basically in the Atlantic, your low-level winds typically blow out of the east. At upper levels, high up in the atmosphere, they blow out of the west. And that tends to tear apart hurricanes climatologically, which is why the Atlantic normally doesn't have as many storms as the Western North Pacific. In a La Nina, that tends to reduce your shear. But in August, the shear was still fairly elevated. And a lot of that wasn't necessarily coming from tropical forcing. It was coming more from mid-latitude forcing. We had what's known as wave breaking. So basically, we had a lot more frontal intrusions into the tropics. And when you have fronts moving into the tropics from the middle latitudes, low pressure areas, that tends to bring in drier air, since the middle latitudes tend to be drier than the tropics, but also a lot of vertical wind shear, especially in the central and western Atlantic. And that really knocked down storm activity, even though we had La Nina, and we also had sub-seasonal tropical variability that was also would normally favor a busy time. So August shear was fairly elevated. September shear was quite low, and we had a very busy month, most notable producing hurricanes Fiona and Ian. And then October actually had extremely high shear, some of the highest shear in October actually on record, even in a La Nina event. And that was likely driven a lot more by sub-seasonal variability that was very harsh for that month. And then basically all that kind of broke down in early November. We got one last flurry. I thought we had a shot in early December, a season hurricane, but it didn't quite get.
Because Phil, the first, we use your Colorado State stuff a lot at weather.com. Is that the first one comes out in August, right? Like, how early do you start really hunkering down to get that forecast started?
Oh, well, I mean, so our first formal forecast comes out in April.
April.
But I look at stuff now. I mean, always.
all year long.
How early is too early, Phil?
No, we don't put out a forecast now, but we're certainly already looking at stuff.
Yeah.
One of the big things that we're monitoring this time of year is what's going on with El Nino. We've been in this really long, prolonged La Nina. So this colder than normal water in the eastern and central tropical Pacific has tended to persist since early March, April time of 2020. So we've had kind of this long, prolonged La Nina event. And there are indications that it may be weakening, but at least in the short term, the winds across the tropical Pacific look to be such that I would expect the La Nina to persist for at least the next maybe month, 2 months. But normally, if you're going to get a change, it occurs during the spring. So March, April, May. And a lot of the models are aggressive at calling for a change, potentially even to El Nino. However, it is important to realize that these models have been aggressive at calling for El Nino for quite a while, and we still haven't seen one.
And I think this is, what, the third La Nina in a row?
Correct. Yeah, we've had 3 years of La Nina in a row. We have not had a four-year La Nina event. I think that would be really, really unlikely, but we could potentially have neutral conditions, which means neither La Nina nor El Nino, and then pretty much all bets are off. You can have a really quiet season. You can have an extremely busy season. Some of the busiest seasons we ever had have been in neutral years, but we've also had really quiet seasons in neutral years. So then it becomes a lot more what's going on in the Atlantic that really kind of dictates then how busy the 2023 season would be. But certainly already now we're kind of monitoring conditions, but we also every year will probably effectively tweak a lot of the models that we use, taking into account what we learned from prior years. So we'll certainly be doing some work for the 2023 season. We'll likely be working on trying to especially anticipate what happened in August. We actually had a PhD student in our research group, the research group that I work in, that spent got her PhD effectively looking at predictions of this and the drivers of it. And there wasn't a ton there on August through October, but I think if we maybe focus on August specifically, because that's tends to be when that wave breaking during the peak months of the season tends to be at its strongest. So we'll be looking at that over the next couple of months to try to better be able to anticipate that for future years.
So Phil, I was just going to say, Brady, didn't you ask Brady how early is too early to forecast? So what is your forecast for 2023, Phil?
Oh, I'm sorry. How early is too early to forecast? Yeah. So yes. Let's see. At this lead time, I'd say 4 to 30 storms, you know, 16 hurricanes. No. I mean, right now, you know, it's really hard to say just because we really don't have a clue what's going to happen with El Nino at this point. You kind of want to see how things play out even by April. So April, the forecast skill is moderate. There is some forecast skill there, but it's not great. Because El Nino, unfortunately, decides you're normally to change during the spring, which is when we're trying to do these forecasts. So we're forecasting Southern Hemisphere. From that perspective, forecasting Southern Hemisphere cyclones is a lot easier than in the Northern Hemisphere. You tend to get these transitions during the spring. So we'll certainly be monitoring those conditions. But I also kind of want to see what plays out in the Atlantic, how those sea surface temperatures trend over the next couple of months. So certainly we'll have a lot more to say with that.
Phil, what goes into forecasts? Like, so you talked about like La Nina, El Nino. What are some other factors that you're looking for? You know, maybe not now because it's a little too early, but like, you know, you get into March, April, May, you're looking at some of these factors. What are you looking at outside of kind of El Nino and La Nina?
Yeah, so a lot of the factors, and it's interesting too, if you look at where the predictors that we use are located, if you look, say, in March, April timeframe, those predictors may be fairly far afield from the Atlantic Ocean. And that's because we're looking more at basically what are known as teleconnections. So if you have wind pressure, sea surface temperature changes in one area, say during the spring, that will then alter the atmospheric circulation in such a way that by the time you get to the summer, it will then say change the water temperatures in the Atlantic. So if you look at our predictors in April, they tend to be fairly far spread a little farther out than what you look at, say, when we're doing our forecast in early August. So a lot of our efforts, even in March, April, is trying to get an idea of what the El Nino is going to do. So we have a statistical model that looks at sea surface temperatures in the tropical Pacific Ocean. So what they are currently, also what the pressure and wind patterns look like in the Pacific Ocean to tend to force what might be happening with El Nino over the next few months. In the Atlantic, we also look at upper level wind patterns over Africa that even in that early lead time can kind of give us an idea as to potentially what the upper level winds might be during the summer. And then we focus a lot on water temperatures, not in the deep tropics, but in the subtropical Atlantic, because when those waters, say, are warmer than normal in the subtropical Atlantic, so say off the west coast of Africa, those waters are warmer than normal, that tends to force lower pressures. And if you have lower pressures, that tends to force weaker winds on the southern periphery of that lower pressure. And that weaker winds lead to less mixing, churning up of the ocean surface, which leads to basically the oceans obviously warming up every year from spring to summer, but anomalously warming, so warming up faster than normal.
Yeah, I mean, that's super interesting, right? Because you have all these different factors at play. And, you know, they're you know, La Nina, El Nino, those, you know, translate to certain things, the hurricane season. But even off of the coast of Africa with the waters, I mean, I didn't even think about that, right? But that makes total sense because that's where they form. That's where those, you know, systems tend to form. Is there any, like, around the Gulf, any factors you're looking at? Are you waiting till August or September to, like, look, you know, I guess maybe even July, to look at, like, you know, sea surface temperatures around there? You know, because obviously you can't predict those in April or May, or can you?
Yeah, so I mean, the Gulf of Mexico is interesting because it actually is a fairly low predictability region. So trying to be able to predict, say, storm activity in the Gulf. And some of that is because our prediction skill generally come from the deep tropics. And storms that form in the deep tropics typically form off the coast of Africa. They may form in the Caribbean. Storms in the Gulf, they can form in the Gulf in situ. And if they form in the Gulf, they may form from frontal systems, things like that, especially early and late season. Those don't necessarily correlate as much with the kind of predictors that we normally use for a seasonal forecast. Whereas if you look, say, at storms forming in the Caribbean, tropical Atlantic, most of those do form from basically waves or disturbances coming off of Africa. And that's where we have our highest levels of predictability. I would say if I had to pick one predictor, the best predictor that we have prior to the peak of the season is we look at the strength of the low-level winds, so the winds just above the ocean surface, the trade winds, in the Caribbean during July. When those are weaker than normal, that tends to mean a very, very busy season is coming up. And that's due to the fact that to get those weaker winds, you need to have high pressure in the eastern Pacific, which typically means you have a La Nina. It means it also means you have lower pressures in the Atlantic, which means a more unstable atmosphere, basically just a harbinger of a very busy season. Also, if you have weaker winds at low levels, that tends to reduce those levels of vertical wind shear, which is, again, critical for forming storms. Also, when you have those weaker winds, again, you have the less churning up, mixing up of the ocean surface, allowing for the waters to warm up. And obviously, warmer waters providing more fuel for hurricanes to develop and intensify.
Do you have, I mean, obviously we get the spaghetti models that come out whenever there's a hurricane and everybody's talking about spaghetti. Is there one model that you're like, yeah, that's really kind of my model I look for? And are there any new improvements or new models coming out in that area? Are you just seeing anything or, oh, we've reached the peak. We've done the best we can.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I look at everything under the kitchen sink when it comes to models. Since my focus is more, I mean, I obviously look at what's going on with individual storms and what's going to happen the next day. More of my focus on what's going to happen later. So what's going to happen the next week or two. So even say, for example, when there's, say, a storm like Hurricane Ian that's bearing down on Florida, I'm providing content on that storm, but I'm also looking at what might be coming on down the pike. And so I use basically a variety of ensembles. So there's tools both from the U.S. ensemble, so from the Global Forecast System, they have the GEFS ensemble, which has a bunch of, basically what you do is you take your observations at a particular time, and then you basically tweak them to kind of basically estimate the uncertainty in those observations, and you run those forward in time. And so those very small perturbations at the start, basically those errors grow with time. So it kind of gives you a good idea of kind of the spread. So I'll look at the forecast of actual where tropical cyclones may develop, also kind of what the large scale is going to be. So looking at that, as well as the ones from the European Center. One thing that is cool is the European Center is going to start at some point early this year, I think they said, maybe even the next few weeks, putting out their 46-day forecast every day. Be really, really nice to have that data available. Honestly, one of the things I kind of want to see is how stable are those forecasts going down the pike. Obviously, if you're looking at tropical cyclone genesis, once you get beyond week one, especially once you get beyond week two, there's not a lot of skill there. So what I look at more than where the model say storms are forming is more like what the environment's going to look like. Because basically, if the environment is more conducive or less conducive, you're likely to see more or fewer storms. But, you know, some of these ensembles, they can give you good information, but the ensembles are very bullish going into late August, and we still had nothing for a couple of weeks, and then pretty much everything really broke down in September, or got really busy in September. So I look at everything, and just because one model does well with one storm or does well one year doesn't guarantee that model is going to do better the following year. Yeah. Because when you're looking at these global models, they're basically built kind of their max, their target skill metric is like the 500 millibar geopotential height anomaly. And so that's basically, if they can improve that globally, then that's when they put out a lot of these model upgrades. So when that's kind of your baseline skill metric, that may or may not improve the hurricane forecasts. So certainly some years models may do great with mid-latitude weather, but not necessarily predict the tropics as well. And models, some models will just struggle with a particular storm. They won't do well with the storm for whatever reason, depending on, and so, yeah, I look at everything under everything but the kitchen sink with all these, with seasonal forecasting, sub-seasonal forecasting, and with day-to-day forecasting of hurricanes. I spend way too much time looking at models, which is one reason why normally if your wife asks you what you're doing in the middle of the night and you say you're looking at models, you know, normally she's going to smack you. Right. I'm going to work, it's okay.
Weather models.
Phil, exactly. She knows the kind of model I'm talking about.
Yeah, she knows. But you did say one thing that caught my attention. You were saying you were looking at pressures off Africa really early in the season when we usually don't get a lot of stuff forming off Africa till later in the season. So that just caught my attention. And, you know, why are you looking at that so intensely?
Yeah, so we're actually not even looking, I'd say, like right off the coast of Africa where the storms come off. We're looking even higher. We're looking higher latitudes. So say like 25 to 35, 40 degrees north. And it's basically what happens is if you have basically a weaker subtropical high pressure system, so a weaker Azores high, what that does during the spring is when you have that weaker high pressure, basically that reduces your pressure gradient. So you get weaker low level winds blowing across the tropical Atlantic. And that means effectively allows for the tropical Atlantic to warm up faster during the spring into the summer. And that leads to basically just more fuel for storms when we get to the peak season. So during the spring into the early summer, I look a lot at pressures in more of the subtropics. And then for the peak of the season, then I start looking more at pressures in the peak of in basically what's known as the main development region. So where the storms typically form, which is right off the coast of Africa. Bill Gray used to always say, you know, if he could pick one place to put a grad student, he picked Dakar, Senegal. That's kind of the money spot. If the waves come off around the latitude of Dakar, that's usually where you kind of have the best chance of intensifying. If they come off too much farther north, they tend to recurve, and also the waters up there. If you look at the gradient on sea surface temperatures, as you go farther north, right off the coast of Africa, it gets cold in a hurry. So the systems tend to just die off really quickly.
I'll tell you what, we're getting into some really geeky
I know,
stuff.
I was over here awesome. To ask about the low, it. But I was like, I gotta know.
No, this is good.
Thank you for tuning in to the Stormfront Freaks podcast. You can watch our bi-weekly show live on youtube.com/stormfrontfreaks and download the audio version on your favorite podcast player. For links to our Patreon team of exclusive benefits, show notes, past shows, new videos, merchandise, and more, visit our website at stormfrontfreaks.com. While you're there, check out our interactive chaser radar from our friends at zoomradar.com. If you'd like to contact us with questions or make comments about the show, shoot us an email to questions@stormfrontfreaks.com or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or TikTok. Search for Stormfront Freaks. We'd love to hear from you. Join us next time and tell a friend about the Stormfront Freaks podcast.